and had decided that a translated wave function was related to an untranslated wave function by something that looks a bit like u of t acting on the state vector. And we had got the condition that psi t x psi t ought to be equal to x plus a, which in turn meant that psi u dagger of t x u of t psi was equal to x plus a. And we had made a guess that the operator u should be equal to the exponential of minus I p dot a over h bar. So what we really need to do is to evaluate this expression here and see if it gives the right answer. So if you're faced with evaluating things like this, there are many ways in which you can do it. And I thought I was going to multiply out the exponential, but this changed my mind. So I just want to work out what this object is. E to the plus I p dot a over h bar x e to the minus I, not put the brackets there. Now, we know that it's supposed to be equal to this, but we actually want to prove this and see the easiest way of doing it. Let's first of all turn this into something with suffixes, so we have it in suffix notation instead. So we just say we're going to look at the ith component of this thing. Here, both of these things are three vectors, so we can replace the vectors by putting a suffix here, k, k, and here, l, L. And now all you have to do to evaluate this quantity is to differentiate with respect to AI. Actually, since we've got an I here, perhaps we ought to differentiate with respect to AJ. So that's d by d AJ of the thing that we're interested in. This is equal to, if you differentiate with respect to aj here, you bring down a factor of ip over h bar. There will be a delta a delta jk, because you only differentiate this thing if it's equal to j. And there will be the exponential. It doesn't matter whether you put this p at the beginning of the or the end, because p commutes with itself. So you can put it there. Then you have an xi. Then you have the exponential of the same thing, but with a minus sign. This is independent of a, so you don't get anything. And here you get the same thing, but the other way around. Plus the exponential of xi. Here you're going to get a minus I PL over H bar. A delta LJ. And then the exponential again. And again, it doesn't matter whether you put this P in front of this exponential or at the end, because it commutes with everything in there. So taking that derivative is easy. So the whole thing turns into u dagger, an overall factor of I over h bar. And of course, this is a common factor, both at the beginning and at the end. You have here a pk delta jk xi, which is the same thing as pj xi. And then here you've got the same thing, but the other way around, and with a minus sign. There's an I over h bar which comes out, a minus sign. xi. PL delta LJ is PJ times U. But this is just the commutator of PJ with xi. And since that obeys the Heisenberg algebra, PJ xi is equal to minus I h bar delta ij, this thing is equal to the minus I h bar conspires with this I over h bar to give me a plus 1. And so you end up with u dagger delta ij u. But u dagger u is 1, so this is delta ij. What you see is that when you differentiate things like this, you always end up with commutators sitting in the middle, although if things don't commute, it can get a bit more complicated than that. So d by dAj is just delta ij of this thing. So what is the general solution to that equation? I guess I can erase that with impunity. So that means if we now reverse the process, this thing in square brackets here is the integral of this thing with respect to aj. So it's going to be delta ij aj plus something independent of a. What is that thing? Well, you do know that if a is equal to 0 in this expression, then that's just 1, and you get xi. So if you put a equal to 0, that tells you what this thing that's independent of a is. So this is just equal to xi. And so u dagger xi u is equal to xi plus ai. And this way of doing things often works nicely. So now we know what the translation operator is. And just as in the previous cases, we can figure out what the translation operator does to a general operator by using the idea of translation invariance of some entire system. So if you take the translated state, and you're interested in any operator O that has been translated psi t, this thing is supposed to be equal to the same thing by translation invariance. That is to say, it does not matter where in space you do your experiment. So that tells us how to transform an operator. This thing is psi u dagger o translated u psi. That thing is the same as psi o psi for any operator o. So u dagger o translated is o, or turned round, o t is u o u dagger. You'll notice that translations form a group. Although a very trivial group, it's still a group. The easiest way to see that is just to write out u and think about it for a minute. If you translate through an amount A, a vector, this is equal to the exponential of minus I P dot A over H bar. So what are the properties of a group? There is going to be the identity element in the group. That corresponds to A equals 1. Given any U, you should be able to form a unique inverse. So that just simply corresponds to tending A to minus A, or alternatively taking the Hermitian conjugate. So there is an inverse. Then there is a composition law. If we calculate U of B acting on U of A, that's the same thing as the exponential of minus I P dot B over H bar, exponential of minus I P dot A over H bar. But all these things here commute with each other. P commutes with itself. So this is the same thing as the exponential of minus I over H bar P into A plus B. So this combination of things is the same thing as U of A plus B, simply because everything commutes with each other. And of course, it doesn't matter in which order we did this. This is the same thing as U of A and U of B. So what we've shown here, it's an abelian group. Abelian simply means that any two elements of the group commute with each other. That's what we have here. U of A times U of B is always the same as U of B times U of A, independently of whatever you have chosen A and B to be. So there are all kinds of things that you can do with translations that look a little bit like that. And maybe we'll do a bit more of that a little later on. Now, one thing that you know, I guess, from looking at relativity, is that space and time are very similar. In fact, they're almost the same. So you might expect the same thing to be true if you evolve a system in time. And that's almost true. Let's see how that comes about. A and B live in R3, yeah. So let's look at the Schrödinger equation. But I want to look at this in its time-dependent form. It simply reads, Hamiltonian acting on psi is equal to IH bar d psi by dt. Assuming that h is independent of time, you can just write down the solution to this equation in a sort of operator form. Psi of t is equal to e to the minus I h t over h bar times psi of 0. So this thing you can think of as being a way of starting off with some state at time t equals 0. And ending up with some state vector at time t. All you have done is to act with this operator, e to the minus iht over h bar. If you don't believe me that this solves that equation, just differentiate with respect to t. You get a factor of minus I Hamiltonian over h bar, which conspires with this to give you h. So this is the solution of that equation. This thing is sometimes called the time evolution operator. And in keeping with the rest of my notation, I'll call this thing U. The trouble is that I can't really call it T for time translation, because I use T for translation, so I'll call it theta. And it involves a time. So the time translation is just like any other operator associated with the symmetry of something. Here, if you assume that H is independent of T, you have time translation invariance, and the time evolution operator is this apparently simple looking thing. This too forms an abelian group, because well, let's see, we could decide that we wanted to go from time t to time t prime. So we can change this slightly. Psi of t prime is equal to e to the minus I h t prime minus t over h bar psi of t. So this is a time translation operator, which we could say takes you from the state at time t to the state at time t prime. Yeah?
But I always wonder this. So once you work out what the time evolution operator is in terms of the independent of time Hamiltonian, what's the good of noticing that it forms an abelian group if you already have the operator? Is there some way that it's useful to talk about?
Simple. I will tell you tomorrow. It's how you derive the particle. Good question. So, you might have made Feynman's discovery if you had followed that idea. So, is it an abelian group? Well, the answer is, of course, obviously, yes. If you consider this object, this is the same thing as this, because T commutes with itself. So that's the composition law. And since H commutes with the self, it must be abelian. I guess I should spell this with a capital A, because it's named after Abel. So it's a proper name. Obviously, the identity is when you put t minus t prime equal to 0. The inverse you get by just switching the sign. So that's really all there is to it. The path integral, now getting ahead of myself here, is just splitting this finite translation up into an infinite number of infinitesimal transformations. That's all you do. So now we all know what the path integral is. That's probably too slick. I will deal with it properly tomorrow. At first sight, this kind of expression here looks kind of formal and useless. So I thought it might be a good idea to do a couple of examples to see how you can actually use this in simple situations before doing the path integral to show you how some things evolve in time. So having anything to do with space always complicates things, so let's start off with a spin system. So examples of time translation. So let's start off with what I want to do, an electron in a uniform magnetic field at rest in a uniform magnetic field. Actually, although I did this one way, I wonder if I should do it a different way. Well, whatever. The Hamiltonian under these circumstances is equal to minus mu dot b, where mu is the magnetic dipole moment of the electron. And b is the externally applied magnetic field. If we want to know what mu is in terms of fundamental constants, it is equal to g spin, so-called g factor of the electron, Bohr magneton, times the spin vector divided by h bar. If we're interested in what the Bohr magneton is, that's equal to e h bar over 2 times the mass of the electron, and a factor of, that's it. The spin, sorry, g spin of the electron is equal to 2, and of course the spin vector is equal to a half h bar times sigma. Have you all seen this expression before? No, the whole thing.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So that's not mysterious. It's possible this factor of g spin is equal to 2. Is that mysterious? You've seen it before. You know how to derive it. Oh, it's a mystery. Oh, all right. When we do the Dirac equation, then we will do that. Let me see. What I was going to do, well, I can still do it. It's not a problem. So let's do a very simple example to see how this works. Let's suppose that at t equals 0, the spin of the electron is up in the z direction. And let's also, for the sake of argument, suppose that the applied magnetic field is B in the 0 in the x direction, constant in space and time. Then the Hamiltonian will collapse down to minus mu, which we said was equal to g spin mu b over h bar, then the spin is a half h bar sigma, and the magnetic field is going to be in general b, but this is going to be equal to b0 times the unit vector in the x direction. Does anyone mind if I call that I hat temporarily? So that this thing is equal to minus g spin mu b h bar, no, the h bar's gone, a 2 on the bottom, a sigma x times b0. The easiest thing to do is to say that this is equal to minus c times b0, where c is some positive constant. Actually, maybe c gets confused with the speed of light here. Let's change it to k. Now, how are we going to represent our wave functions? Well, the simplest thing to do is to say that the wave function for the electron contains two components. The only thing that's interesting is the spin. Yeah? Sigma x, yes. Actually, why don't I absorb the b0 into k? So the wave function for the electron is just going to be a two-component object corresponding to the amount of stuff that is in spin up or spin down, and you start off in the state 1, 0. So this is just the spin wave function for the electron. And in our favorite representation of the sigma matrices, sigma x is 0, 1, 1, 0. So there are two things that we could do now. We could say that at time t, psi is going to be equal to alpha of t, beta of t. And we could stick this into the Schrödinger equation and get IH bar d by dt of alpha and beta is equal to the Hamiltonian. So that's minus k and explicitly, this is equal to minus k sigma x 0, 1, 1, 0, alpha, beta. And turn this into two coupled differential equations and solve it. There is nothing wrong with doing that. You will get the answer. You will, however, get the answer rather more inelegantly than by doing it using the fact that you know how to have a general expression for the time translation operator. So the other way of doing it would be to simply say, well, I know that the time translation operator is always equal to e to the iht over h bar with a minus sign. That's the time translation operator. And for our explicit Hamiltonian, h is equal to minus k times sigma x, where k was a positive constant. So what this thing amounts to is e to the I, these two minus signs cancel, k sigma x t over h bar. So all you need to do is to work out that exponential. I guess you have done those kinds of things before when we were looking at rotations. So do I just need to write down the answer, or do you want me to derive it? I don't know. Just write it down. Well, the answer is going to be equal to cos kt over h bar times the unit matrix plus sigma x times sine kt over h bar the plus I. Right. So that tells you what this thing is as a function of time, just by having this thing act on the initial state. So you know at all subsequent times, the wave function is going to be cos kt over h bar plus I sigma x sine kt over h bar acting on the state 1, 0. So that's just going to be equal to cos, and this is going to be equal to I sine kt over h bar. So that the electron will oscillate up and down between spin up and spin down with an angular frequency governed by k over h bar. it is somewhat easier to do this than it is to solve the differential equations explicitly. It's the same process, but it's kind of easier to do it this way. There is something which I think we'll just leave as illustrative at the moment. If you look at this thing, you'll notice the norm of this vector is preserved. That is to say, that the probability of spin up, that is going to be cos squared kt over h bar, plus the probability of spin down, that's going to be sine squared kt over h bar, always adds up to 1. This is a consequence of the fact that the operator U is unitary. If that is not obvious, then let's think of what psi of t is going to be. That's equal to psi of 0 U dagger of t. This one is U of t psi of 0. U dagger U is equal to 1, so the norm is preserved. You have unitary time evolution that always preserves total probability. So this is a good check on whether you've done your calculation correctly or not. So that's how you deal with a simple spin system. Yeah?
Of t that goes because it has to be dimensionless h over h bar.
You said on left hand factor.
H over h bar.
The h bar.
Kt.
I think it's because my Hamiltonian was k sigma x.
The H bar.
I could have got rid of it if I tried harder, but there doesn't seem to be any need. Well, let's move on to a slightly different problem, which will relate. Doing this will help us do path integrals. So let's look at this one. I just want to look at the free particle in one-dimensional space. This is example 2. A free particle in one-dimensional space will obey the one-dimensional Schrödinger equation, which is minus h bar squared over 2m, d2 psi by dx squared equals I h bar d psi by dt. You can think of this as being the kinetic energy operator, so I want you to have in mind that this thing really is p squared over 2m as an operator. Now, if you want to work out how this thing changes as you evolve in time, then of course you have to know what the wave function is initially. So let's suppose that the initial state is given by the wave function psi of 0x. Now we could try to do things clever with the Hamiltonian, but I think I want to use a brute force method of solving this equation. So the aim is to find psi as a function of x and t for all t. So how would you do that? Well, all right. That didn't produce much response. Well, if I suggested doing this as a math problem as opposed to a physics problem, we'd have no difficulty doing it, would we? We'd just say, oh, well, you Fourier transform everything, solve the resultant first-order differential equation for time evolution. So you do a Fourier transform in space. So I ought to define Fourier transforms for you, because there's a potential for a little bit of confusion concerning conventions. Indeed, I managed to confuse myself when doing this. So that's why I know that there's potential for confusion. So if I start off with some function of position in one dimension, f of x, I want to define the Fourier transform to be f tilde of p, p being like momentum, is going to be the integral over all x, say from minus infinity to plus infinity, f of x, e to the I p x over h bar. Now I have to be careful about which sign I use here, because that's kind of important. I need a minus sign sitting in front of this. And, annoyingly, you need a factor of 1 over root 2 pi h bar here. So that's the Fourier transform for me. If we were mathematicians, we wouldn't have an h bar there. And so you wouldn't have one there. And you'd be appalled by having a root 2 pi here. Because you would usually say, well, if I want to invert a Fourier transform, the inversion formula is this. F of x is equal to the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dp, f tilde of p, e to the plus ip x over h bar, and I will need a 1 over root 2 pi h bar here. And of course, a mathematician would say, well, you have just a 1 over 2 pi here, you don't have these horrible square roots everywhere. There is a reason for doing this. The reason for putting these root 2 pi h bars absolutely everywhere is so that the norm of a wave function is preserved. You will see exactly what I mean in the example that we're going to do. So that's my definition of Fourier transformation. Now, we want to Fourier transform this entire equation. So the first obstacle that we come across is that we need to know what the Fourier transform of d psi dx is. Well, that's going to be 1 over root 2 pi h bar integral, I won't write in the limits all the time, it's a bit boring, d psi by dx e to the minus I p x over h bar. So the way in which you tackle this is just to integrate by parts. In which case this is minus 1 over root 2 pi h bar, integral dx psi d by dx of e to the minus I p x over h bar. I have omitted the boundary terms because it is generally hoped, wished, or sometimes even true that psi vanishes sufficiently far away from any region of interest. So the boundary terms you just forget about. If you really wanted to be rigorous about this, you would start worrying about distributions and whether or not something was a Schwarz function, but I really don't want to do anything like that. Now you differentiate this with respect to x. It gives you a factor of minus ip over h bar. But I and p and h bar don't depend on x, so they can come out of the integral. But this is just the same as the Fourier transform. So this is equal to I p over h bar minus psi tilde of p. In other words, if you want to take the Fourier transform of the derivative of something, you just multiply by I p over h bar. So if you want to take the Fourier transform of d2 psi by dx squared, you just do it twice. So this would be I p over h bar squared, acting on psi tilde of p. Is the step from there to there obvious? You just do it twice. Each time you do it, you get a factor of I p over h bar. So what happens here? This equation, you have a minus h bar squared over 2m. You then have the second derivative here. That gives me minus p squared over h bar squared psi tilde of p and t. Here, d by dt doesn't do anything, so it's I h bar d by dt of psi tilde of p and t. We should not feel surprised by that. Can I get rid of this?
No. Sorry, I couldn't copy it off.
Yeah, don't worry. Tell me when I can get rid of it, that's all.
Isn't this all very circular?
Yes. If you have seen it before. I don't know whether you have or you haven't.
Oh, I just mean like you're starting with the Fourier equation, given by p squared over 2m. You might mention it in the x basis in the Fourier transform.
So you suggested that that was a Schrodinger equation in momentum representation, which I think is what you're saying. And that's fine if you've seen it before, but not fine if you haven't seen it before. I don't know, how many people have seen it before? Most, but not all. So that was worth the effort. Now you can just solve this equation. It's kind of easy. This is a function of t here. That's easy. Psi tilde of p and t is equal to e, I'll worry about the signs in a minute, I p squared over 2m h bar times t. And I think we need a minus sign there, times psi tilde of p0. Let's see if I've got the same sign twice. Yes. If you just think about this, what you've done is that you've, this wave function here, psi tilde of p, tells you how it tells you the distribution of momenta of various particles. One of the various state bits of the wave function. This part here tells you that a bit of the wave function that has got momentum p evolves as if it has energy p squared over 2m. And that controls the evolution of that part of the wave function. So that is a general formula for dealing with the time evolution of something. So now we want to actually evolve some specific state. It would be nice to evolve the state corresponding to a particle localized at a point. However, you quickly realize that is an impossibility. So let's suppose you thought about a particle localized at the origin, so its wave function would be something like that. You would probably be tempted to say that means that the wave function is a delta function. But that's absolutely no good whatsoever. You can't do this. That's because psi star psi dx would be then the integral of delta of x squared dx, which at best you would say was something like delta of 0, and that does not make any sense. So this does not work. Don't try it. The best way to think about a particle that is somewhat localized is just to say, well, I'm going to try to localize it, so let's think of some wave function that is somewhat localized. So let's think about a wave function that looks something like this. So it's just a Gaussian wave function. Let's suppose that we start off with a particle centered at the origin. There's no loss of generality to do that. In which case, you can just simply construct a wave function that looks like psi of x is equal to e to the minus x squared over 2 lambda. If you're interested in the probability density, that's just the square of that. That's just e to the minus x squared over lambda. And if you think about this picture here, the width of the pump here is really governed by the value of lambda. You would like your wave function to be properly normalized. So the integral of psi star x psi of x dx is equal to the integral of minus x squared over lambda from minus infinity to plus infinity dx. And that is equal to root pi lambda. I hope everyone knows how to do these Gaussian integrals. Say now if you do not. Do not. Ha, huh. No. Let's have a digression about how to do Gaussian integrals. So let's, for the sake of argument, say we're interested in the function e to the minus alpha x squared. And we want to evaluate the integral minus infinity to plus infinity e to the minus alpha x squared dx. Let's call that thing I. Well, you obviously can't just integrate this thing in terms of elementary functions, because you can't think of anything when differentiated that will give this. I mean, you could try things like x e to the minus alpha x squared, and it doesn't work. There is a trick, and that is to work out the square of this integral. That's the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dx e to the minus alpha x squared, integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dy e to the minus alpha y squared. Everything here is convergent. So I could regard this as a multiple integral over the entire xy plane. So if you do that, then what will happen? Well, that's just as bad, you've made no progress. But you can describe the xy plane in one of two ways. You can either describe it in terms of x and y, or you can take, turn this into polar coordinates and say that x, point xy, is the same thing as the point r cos theta, r sine theta, where r is that distance and theta is that distance. Then dx dy is equal to the Jacobian of this transformation, where this thing, modulus I should say, is equal to dx dr, dx d theta, dy dr, dy d theta, which in this case is equal to dx dr is cos theta, dx d theta is minus r sine theta, dy dr is sine theta, this one is r cos theta. And so if I take the determinant of this, you get r cos squared plus r sine squared, which is equal to r. So this is equal to r dr d theta. So this expression becomes the integral of r dr d theta. Think about the limits of r and theta. Well, r theta goes from 0 to 2 pi all the way around this thing, and r goes from 0 to infinity. Theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. And the integrand, e to the minus alpha x squared plus y squared, that's e to the minus alpha r squared, is now an elementary integral, because this thing is essentially the derivative of that thing. So this is going to be the integral from 0 to 2 pi d theta. If we do the r integral, you get e to the minus alpha r squared, a half and an alpha on the bottom, and a minus sign. So if you differentiate this, you see you get minus 2 alpha r. So that cancels that. 2 alphas gives you an r up here. You need to put in the limits, 0 to infinity. At infinity, you get nothing. At the origin, this thing is just 1. So you get the integral from 0 to 2 pi d theta, 1 over 2 alpha. The integral from theta, 0 to 2 pi, is trivial. You just give 2 pi, so this is pi over alpha. So that's the quick way of doing these Gaussian integrals. Is everyone happy with that? No. So, in this case, I've got lost. So my psi of x was supposed to be equal to e to the minus x squared over 2 lambda. So the normalization, so there's some normalization constant you can put in there. We need to evaluate it. The integral of psi star x, psi of x, is supposed to be equal to 1. It's equal to n squared integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the minus x squared over lambda dx. And that's equal to root pi lambda. So the normalization factor is pi lambda to the minus 1/4. So that's my starting psi of x. How many people have seen how this evolves in time before? A small number. Quarter, third, quarter. Okay, so this too is worth doing. So, the first step is to calculate the Fourier transform of psi of x. Psi tilde of p is equal to 1 over root 2 pi h bar integral of dx psi of x e to the, I have to get my signs right, minus here. Right, so substituting in the wave function that we have over here, root 2 pi h bar. A pi lambda to the minus a quarter. Then we have the integral of dx from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the minus x squared over 4 lambda minus ipx over h bar. Now, I guess that if there was a bit of a problem with Gaussian integrals before, there are going to be problems with this Gaussian integral. So let's try to do that integral in generality. This is the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of something like e to the minus ax squared. Well, let's say plus bx. And in our particular case, a is equal to minus 1 over 4 lambda, and b is equal to minus ip over h bar. The trick is to rewrite the thing in the exponential as a perfect square. So you want to write this as x minus something all squared. Well, the signs have miraculously come out right, a minus and a minus. And so if you put here, let's see, b over 2, the intermediate term comes out right. Because if you start multiplying this out, you'll get ax squared with a minus sign. Then you'll get plus ab times 2 over 2 times x, which is... Oh, we need an A on the bottom. Over A. So that's now right. Then the last term is a minus b squared over 4a, which has the advantage of being independent of x, but isn't what we want. So you get rid of it. There are 1, 2, 3 minus signs here, so the whole thing comes with a minus sign. You get a plus e to the b squared over 4a. dx. Here. B squared over 4a squared times a. Now what you do is you invent a change of variables. X prime is equal to x minus b over 2a. So this becomes the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the minus a x prime squared dx prime times e to the b squared over 4a. Now this integral we know how to do, it's root pi over a. And this is e to the b squared over 4a. So that's how you do integrals of that particular form. This result is worth remembering. You need it over and over and over and over again, and even more than that. Especially when doing path integrals, and you need it infinitely often when you do quantum field theory. you might protest that I have done something really bad here. Who can spot what it is?
Because you didn't specify your contour.
Right. It's been a horrible puzzle. Yeah, I did not specify the contour. You're absolutely right. You see, I've shifted x through a complex translation. So what I really ought to do is do a contour interval and show that this interval is the same as that interval. Carefully, being very careful about what I do with infinity. But fortunately, as long as A has got a positive real part, there is no complication in doing that. I don't want to do it, easy to do it yourself. I guess there was one slight problem, so I wrote something stupid down. A is plus 1 over 4 lambda.
A is plus 1 over 2 lambda. Yes. Because psi was e to the cos x.
Oh, yeah.
Lambda. This is.
Why did I get it? That's right. So. Bad thing doesn't actually matter too much. So as long as A has got positive real part, there's no difficulty in doing that sort of complex translation. I mean, what you have to do really is look at the complex x plane, bad notation, never mind. The original integral is this one. The integral that I want is going to be something like that, where this is going to be x minus. What's it called? Plus pi t some positive constant. Then you would say, well, I can close the contour up here as at infinity. Of course, this has got a positive real part. This little line and this little vertical line doesn't contribute anything. Inside this contour, there are no singularities. So the integral all the way around here, there are no cuts or anything nasty, is zero. This is zero, this is zero. So the integral along here is the same as the integral along there. And so you don't have to worry. I guess we do have to worry sometimes if we do something relativistic. So at least if you're not relativistic, you don't have to worry. That's why I leave it at that. Right. So we were trying to calculate this object. Now we've got it right, you might be able to do it. So you get this thing is root 2 times h bar, a pi lambda to minus a quarter, and then this integral, root pi over a. Big A, we said, was 1 over 2 lambda. Then there's a factor of e to the b squared. B is minus I, p over h bar. So you get a minus p squared over h bar squared. A factor of 4 on the bottom. An A on the bottom, which is 2 lambda on the top. And I suppose it might be a good idea to tidy this up a bit. Let's see. H bar to the minus a half. 2 to the plus a half, 2 to the minus a half, that goes away. Pi to the minus a half, pi to the minus 3 quarters, pi to the plus a half is pi to the minus a quarter. Lambda to the plus a half minus a quarter, so that's lambda to the plus a half. It. E to the minus p squared lambda over h bar squared, and a 2. Lambda's a quarter.
Right. Good. So, this is the distribution in the momentum space of this wave function. Let's draw a picture of it. The width of the peak is now given by 1 over lambda. You should not feel surprised by that. If you try to localize a particle by making lambda small, you're going to make the uncertainty in its momentum large from the uncertainty principle. And that's what you found here, because the peak, the width of this peak is given by 1 over lambda, whereas the width of the x peak was given by lambda. So it's an illustration of the uncertainty principle. If you sent lambda to 0, this thing would become just absolutely flat. Again, that's not surprising. If you infinitely localize some particle, this wave function will be infinitely uncertain in momentum, and it will be flat, and that will give you terrible trouble if you try to do this calculation. So you can sort of see that the delta function type limit of wave functions of this form give rise to pathologies. Given that it is now after 4 to past, we should probably stop there for the day. Anybody want to ask any questions about where we've got to so far?
Yeah, about the width of the peak, isn't it like 1 over square root of lambda? Because you have lambda p squared. But then it's still the inverse of the...
It's still the inverse of this. I wasn't too clear. It ought to be the square of lambda because then you've got the right dimensions. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's controlled by lambda. Well, one lambda and one, the other, one over lambda, so yeah. Yeah.
I usually might not want to go into it out of class later, but I was wondering, like, can you show that the inverse is really the inverse?
Oh, you want to prove that the inverse Fourier transform is the inverse Fourier transform?
Yeah, I mean, you can do it with, and like, I know the way we end up with, like, the integral dt e to the I t minus.
Right.
And I've always seen people just assume that the delta function, but you seem to want to avoid delta function.
You want me to do it without using a delta function?
Well, I thought you might have a way to do it since you're...
There is a way to do it. The way it was originally done, I mean, I guess... It will be a bit of a digression, but I'll try and figure out how to do it.
Okay.
I don't want to mention anything awful like Schwarz function. We'll take limits of functions to get distribution. I don't want to do that either. I will concentrate on solutions. Okay. And that's it for today.